Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the Subcommittee on Human Services, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It's Monday, June 15th. We have public hearings on five different bills this morning. We will consider two bills together because they're related to the same topic. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 336 and a public hearing on Senate Bill 337. And even though the agenda is printed in a rather strange way relating to state financial administration, we know that these hearings are about school-based health centers. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Mona Sanderson, State Senator from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I'm a retired public health nurse, and I was actually a school-based health center nurse, school clinic nurse. And so these two bills are extremely important to me because I know how valuable school-based health centers are to the well-being of all students. And in some cases, to the community, because some school-based health centers are now serving their community, like Centennial High School, that even has a dental chair and is serving the community. So I just wanted to say, I realize we're in a crisis with budget, but you know we're always going to be in a crisis. And education is extremely important, and in order to have our children learn, we need to make sure that their health is all right. So with that, I would love to have you consider very seriously Senate Bill 336 and 337. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us this morning. We have one other witness who has signed up to testify on both bills, Doug Riggs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm not Maureen Hinman, although I'll be using Maureen's PowerPoint once it gets put up on the screen. We have two bills before us today for your consideration, and I'll be relatively brief. They've had full hearings both in the House and the Senate, and we had extensive testimony on both, and lots of questions were asked and answered, and I'm here to answer any of those questions. We have had an effort that many of you have been involved in over the past four sessions to update and expand the role of school-based health centers in Oregon. We have increased the number of school-based health centers from 51 to 79 in that period of time. We have 10 more that have gone through a extensive planning process with their local school districts. Remember that school boards have to approve any planning processes. School boards approve the scope of services that can be offered in their school district, and this is really a community-driven activity. So it's really from the ground up. The planning grants that are contained in the two bills are really designed to ensure that during that planning process we get everyone at the table in the community, and also ensure that we have a good financial plan for SBHCs. The state provides about 25% of the cost of running an SBHC through the Oregon Health Authority. Upwards of 75% comes from private fundraising, grants from foundations, local community support ranging from business support, chambers of commerce, school districts, et cetera, that contribute into these school-based health centers. But the bottom line is the state is investing only about a quarter of the cost of running an SBHC, and I think that's a very good value on the dollar. I want to make four quick points, and there's quite a bit more information online. I really think that
Mr. Riggs, there going to be a presentation?
I thought, yeah, Maureen has one on. So, yeah, could you bring the one I emailed you this morning? Okay, that's fine. I can just go through four quick points. And,
okay, thank you.
It is on OLIS.
On OLIS, Maureen Hinman presentation, and I'm not Maureen Hinman, but she wasn't able to be here today. Just four quick points on SBHCs, and I'll be happy to take some questions. School-based health centers really have moved into the 21st century over the past decade. 94% of them have electronic medical records and electronic health records. 90% plus are billing, which is very important, so they're integrated with the healthcare system. We wrote them into statute two sessions ago. We've asked them to coordinate with public health, community partners such as child welfare and housing providers, and CCOs as well. So this is really an important point. We did update, and I want to cover this point, we updated the notification standards for parents, and that was a point that came up in the House and Senate hearings. I'll just remind the committee that anyone under the age of consent of 15, any child, we must notify the parents of services being provided. Every parent must sign a release form at the beginning of the school year, but that does not excuse the school-based health center from following up with parents and notifying them of care for anyone under the age of consent. So that's a very clear statutory requirement. One of two more quick points. We're increasingly realizing that if we really want to combat chronic absenteeism and begin to address the graduation rates in Oregon, we have to focus on the kids who have many of the ACEs scores and the childhood trauma issues that we faced and that you've certainly talked about in this committee.
And could you please repeat what ACEs?
Yeah, Adverse Childhood Experiences Study was a study designed by the Kaiser Family Foundation, and it's a way to measure the level of trauma that a child has endured in his or her life. A score of 4 or more ACEs leads to a life of chronic health conditions, a likelihood that you will not graduate from high school, increased possibility of being unemployed, and a lifetime of health and other issues. And so kids are resilient, and so the extent that we can identify children with those obstacles and get to them earlier through an SBHC, through community health, through the foster care system, et cetera, we have a much better chance of making sure that they become healthy adults. So we really focused on that. Studies on a national basis show that schools with school-based health centers reduce chronic absenteeism and increase graduation rates, and we're really trying to focus on the results of those studies, integrate those findings into our school-based health centers in Oregon. And the last thing I want to say is, number one, a thank you to this committee for providing additional mental health dollars in the last session. About $4.2 million of that translated into mental health counselors in school-based health centers around the state. That provided for 29 counselors in school-based health centers. And in those schools, we're seeing mental health visits of approximately 40% of the overall visits at those SBHCs, which illustrates that there was a chronic need for mental health counseling in those schools that was not being met earlier. And again, mental health issues are key to being able to address the whole issues of absenteeism, success in school, graduation, et cetera. So,
but what statistic was that you just presented?
Well, we believe that approximately 40% of the visits at schools with a counselor have been mental health or behavioral health visits.
Thank you.
So that speaks to the need, the growing need for this kind of service. So we really appreciate that. So I know my red light is on and I won't take any longer, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative. Thank you. I'm, as you know, very supportive of this area. I have two quick questions. One has to do with the finances itself, because one bill is around expanding for 11 centers, and the other bill is around technical assistance and planning for new centers. Is that chunk that's planning for new centers geared toward the 11, or has that planning been done and this is for ongoing after the 11?
Madam Chairman, Representative Kindergarten, that's a very good question. So we originally had three bills. We wanted one bill. Legislative Council separated them into two. So Senate Bill 336 includes two elements. One is an element to bring all school-based health centers up to parity at $60,000 per year. Currently, if you have more than one school-based health center in a county, you only get $53,000 per school-based health center. Mm-hmm. And the $7,000 might not sound like a lot, but we put our green eye shades and dot all the I's and cross the T's, and so 7,000 is fairly important. So if you're in Multnomah County or Benton County or in Jackson County, you get less per school-based health center than if you only have one. Mm-hmm. So that's element number one. The second element of Senate Bill 336 provides for planning grants for the next cycle.
The next, not these 11, but the next.
Right, the next cycle. We asked the OHA to do a survey of school districts and asked them how many might be interested in planning for a school-based health center in their district when they didn't have one. 26 school districts came back and expressed an interest in planning for SBHCs. Again, a local process. So this builds in the funding for up to 11 or 12, depending on the cost. 11 or 12 ones for the 2017-19 expansion. Senate Bill 337 originally included money to pay for the expansion for the $60,000 for 11 health centers, but it turns out that OHA built in seven of those centers into their budget, base budget. So as it turns out, as I was talking to Linda earlier, we only need $360,000 for that to fund three sites that Kaiser stepped up to the plate and funded for planning.
Great.
So Kaiser provided grants for three sites to do their planning, their financial analysis, make sure that we have financial stability over the long term. And so we only need a portion of what we asked for originally in Senate Bill 337.
So the second question, policy, is the are you able to easily get what the absenteeism is caused by? I know that Chalkboard and others have done a lot of work that links high rates of absenteeism to low dropout, and I think that the school-based health clinics are critical in meeting this. And I'm not sure if they've yet dug down into what is causing that absenteeism, but I would think that would be very valuable information for your communities in deciding where they want to put their health clinics. Are you able now to start getting that kind of data?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, that's a really, really good question. A year ago last January, we hosted a conference here in Salem that brought almost 300 people in the Salem Convention Center from education, housing, DHS, child welfare, OIA, across the spectrum to talk about that very issue. That led to a follow-up conference and the presentation report by Upstream Public Health in November, talking specifically about chronic absenteeism. And this is something we are trying to get better statistics on from a local perspective. We haven't done a good enough job of analyzing exactly what all the causes are per school district. We know the general causes. Families in crisis, foster kids, runaway homeless youth tend to be obviously more chronically absent. Mental health issues are a serious issue, and so the funding that was provided last session was very helpful. But there are a number of causes, and we're hosting a conference and then a series of regional forums in the next 6 or 8 months to try to get to exactly that point. I will say from the school-based health center perspective that we need to do a better job of collecting that data at each school-based health center, working with our district, and then coming up with good statistics and comprehensive numbers, and that's what we're hoping we're going to be able to get to by next session or 2017. So we have better data on, in Oregon, what are the causes and what are the solutions.
Thank you.
Okay. That completes the testimony on these two bills, Senate Bills 336 and 337. I'm closing the public hearing. Thank you for being here. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2547 related to housing.
Chair Nathans and members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and on OLIS you should have the fiscal impact. There should be a dash A5 amendment. That's it. And
okay. Thank you.
Three people signed up to testify.
Okay. House Bill 2547, there are three signed to testify. Would you like to all come up at the same time? Melissa Unger, Ozzy Rose, John Mullen. And we're going to use the timer because for these next three bills, we have several people each signed up to testify.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEAU Local 503. I think we should be able to be quick. We worked on this bill extensively in the Human Services Committee, and we actually had brought forward a much more extensive bill relating to housing with services, which is an innovative project that's combining low-income housing and wraparound services for seniors. And the bill that we originally brought forward, I think, had put a lot of stuff into statute about how this how we would move forward with this new setting, but I think once we got into it, we realized that there's lots of questions that just need to be answered and lots of discussion that needs to be had. There's a great pilot project happening in Portland right now, and I think we want to learn from that pilot project and then figure out how does this setting differ from other different kinds of settings that seniors live in and get services in, and how do we make sure that as we move forward that we just have clear
clear definitions of what is housing with services, what is not housing with services. I think we worked with all the interested parties and have consensus among everyone that this is the right way to move forward, and that we agree that the other thing is that we really do agree that a tight timeline is necessary. So we're really hoping to have a tight timeline with a very specific recommendations that would be brought forward and a very specific membership to the committee. We do have one amendment, the -A5 amendment. That was an amendment we agreed to make in committee, which was one, to make sure that we were clear that the legislators appointed to this work group would be from both parties, and the other was to make sure that we added the Housing and Community Services Department, which was accidentally taken off in an amendment. So that is the amendment that we have, and I can take any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Ross.
Good morning, members of the committee. Chairman, I'm Ozzie Rose. I represent the Leading Age organization, and one of our members was a key player in developing this model, or pilot here in Oregon. It is a service or a way to provide services that's spreading across the country, and we've been involved with all the parties, and we support the bill. We need to move ahead with this kind of project. I've got about 10 minutes worth of stuff to describe it to you, but we did that in a policy question, and as I understand the lights, you don't want 10 minutes. But we support the bill, and we support the amendment. Thank you.
Well, that was quick. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I think probably the question that could come up for committee members is, why is this an issue? Housing and services go together, and all of us agree. What happened is that we have a mature long-term care system, and the project that got funded through a state innovation model grant through the state took a number of us by surprise. The Cedars-Sinai project in Portland has three landlords, 11 buildings, and numerous providers. And it has an LLC that governs it. And actually, it's working really pretty well. But the fact of the matter is that it was a little bit of a surprise to many advocates. And so Department of Human Services was willing to have some discussion on it. But what I think is really good about this bill is it's a consensus among a number of different organizations and people to say, we need to have some discussion about these kinds of models and how rights and responsibilities of clients, health and safety issues, choice will all be upheld in that process. So I'm really looking forward to the results of this particular discussion. And we support the amendment that adds housing and community services that Melissa spoke to, and support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Yes, Senator.
Thank you. And I'm looking at this, and I really support the concept, because I think as we talk about, you know, the aging population and actually continuing our long-term care system. But what I noted on your task force, where's the private sector? I see, you know, all those entities that are there, so I wanted to know where the private sector is, particularly as we look about the development and affordability.
Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, we've worked closely with the Oregon Healthcare Association and others on this bill, and I think that there is a variety of different places that we believe they fit into the task force, the providers of services to residents of housing facilities, organizations that advocate for seniors. I mean, we do intend that the Oregon Healthcare Association would likely try to get on this task force, and they have been worked with us closely to develop this task force.
Ma'am. And one other place, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose again, and specifically the I'm trying to find my chart. I had it right here because I knew you were going to ask that question.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, while Ozzie is looking, I would just say that we believed also that legal aid should be part of this discussion, and that we're not named, and this is really okay with us because we fully intend to be at the meetings and be able to provide public comment when we can.
Yeah,
right here. Item F.
Yes.
Excuse me.
E.
On the amended version. Two individuals representing statewide nonprofit organizations that advocate for the service and needs of others. One of those will be a for-profit.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to double check. You mentioned the dash 5 amendments. I'm only seeing dash 4s online.
They're not online yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But they'll be coming, I'm assuming.
Yes, but we'll get them up there. They should be up there.
Great. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you for being here. There's no one else signed up to testify. I don't see anyone else in the audience. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2547.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Senate Committee on...
Are you on 617?
Yes, 617.
Let me open a hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 617.
And Senate 617 comes to you from the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. You should have a fiscal impact statement and a no revenue impact statement on OLIS. The bill establishes a 13-member task force on housing for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Okay. Someone has put a mark on here with four people to testify. It's pretty uncomfortable to squeeze four there. It's hard to talk. But if that's what you want to do, that's your choice. It looks like Ross, Leslie, Anna, and Jaime.
That's it.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Sutton. I represent the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We're a group of about 30 organizations that work to improve equality and community integration for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We believe that housing is a fundamental step in creating a life in your community. We support Senate Bill 617 because it will empower a task force to create a strategic housing plan for people with IDD. We have three main reasons, very briefly, that we believe this is important. One, more people with IDD, intellectual and developmental disabilities, want to live independently in their communities. In fact, 3 out of 4 families say that their child with a disability will grow up and live independently as an adult. That's in a recent survey from the Oregon Consortium of Family Networks. We also had very compelling testimony on the Senate Human Services Committee talking about that very thing. It's on OLIS if you need to check that. But current subsidized housing programs and also the developmental disability system do not have access and resources to really meet this growing demand. Second, as part of the Fairview closure, Oregon built 191 group homes. It currently offers housing to about 800 people. And we built it with 30-year bonds. Believe it or not, it's been 30 years. And in fact, 47 of these bonds will expire in the next 4 years. And when those bonds mature, equity will go to the housing provider organization. And in some situations, that will mean that there's no obligation to continue to serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities or access to maintenance dollars. So it's time to create a plan for what to do with these houses. It's time to create a plan that talks about how we continue to have a system that can truly meet these needs. And finally, the K plan, the Community First Choice Plan, offers individualized supports for people that actually meets their needs. And so this is unprecedented in Oregon. And what we're finding, what providers are telling us, and what families and self-advocates are telling us, is that they no longer need to live in a group home, and they want to move out on their own. But finding that accessible housing is very difficult. The K plan can provide the supports to stop turnover and things like that, but we truly do need the task force. Senate Bill 617 will give an opportunity to have a thoughtful approach to using existing assets consistent with the values and the mission of the DD system, and will allow us to protect the current generation and future generations. So thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Ross Langan. I'm speaking on behalf of OSAC, which is a statewide group of 30 people that we meet. And I'll be doing my testimony in an interview style.
My name is Anna Lansky, co-chair and assistants, members of the committee. I'm a deputy director for Office of Developmental Disability Services.
Excuse me, could you? Perfect. Yeah, you don't have to make it too close, but that helps.
You're right. It is uncomfortable. And Ross has asked me to support him in his testimony by asking him interview questions. So the first question is, why does this task force matter for Oregon Self-Advocacy Coalition?
The task force will help us so we can be out in the community. And OSAC believes that we should have a right, and it was a promise when Fairview closes. And it would also help us to have our own homes and part of our own homes.
Second question. What happens when people with intellectual and developmental disabilities cannot find affordable housing?
In that case, we'll be either out on the streets or in the state hospital or group homes. Or the worst case scenario, move back into it with our parents.
Co-chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Anna Lansky. I'm the deputy director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services. The department is neutral on this bill, but everybody knows that a place to call their own home is a right that every one of us has. It is well known that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have special challenges locating affordable as well as accessible housing. Oftentimes, the market rates for renting an apartment or house are well above what a person on typical SSI can afford. Accessibility also of space is very challenging, as well as having ability to get the supports that they need to live independently. With implementation of the Community First Choice program, or also known as the K plan, in-home services and supports have become more available to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, as well as services such as home modifications to make the spaces where people live more accessible for people that have physical disabilities as well. Additionally, CMS has issued a rule defining the settings in which federal dollars can fund home and community-based services, defining what does it mean to be home and community-based setting. And also, the rule emphasizes the choice of the individual about where they want to live as well as receive services, and also to make sure that the settings in which people live and receive services help and promote integration, full integration into the community for this individual, including access and employment and other services in the community, just like anybody else without disabilities would. So more and more people, like Leslie said, are choosing to live in more independent settings, their own apartments, their own homes. And DHS is looking forward to working with this task force to identify strategies to help people with intellectual and developmental disabilities accessing affordable and accessible housing. Thank you very much. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Jamie Danielle. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. We work to advance social and policy change so that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities can participate in community life just as others without disabilities. The Council is federally mandated to assure that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families have access to services and supports that promote the values of self-determination, independence, and inclusion in all facets of community life. Housing is a critical service that supports these values. As Anna said, having a place to call your own is critically important to all aspects of life and participation in the community. The Council has offered to staff the task force established under Senate Bill 617, and we can do this within our existing staffing and funding structures. The Council has a long history of advocating for accessible community and affordable community housing for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We were very involved in closing the Fairview Training Center. We were also involved in establishing the Fairview Trust. and were involved in the advisory committee which oversaw the trust until a loan was taken in 2011. We're very excited for this opportunity to help increase access to accessible and affordable housing in communities for Oregonians with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. This is actually just a brief comment, if I may. As you all know, in 2013, we passed Senate Bill 450, which led to the Task Force on Streamlining Delivery of Human Services, which Senator Winters and I served on. And while that group focused primarily on self-sufficiency for people living in poverty or near poverty, this is exactly in line with that, and it's a really important idea and concept. And we want is for every Oregonian to be living to the maximum of his or her potential, and coordinating services like this with housing is a critical part of that, and I'm very excited about this bill. So thank you very much for bringing it.
Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Senator.
Yeah. And I'm going to go back in time because it was before the closure of Fairview. Mm-hmm. When we, actually embarked on, and then it was called People's First, which led to a lot of work that led to closing Fairview. But part of that concept was total integration into communities, including not only service but housing. And this task force that you're talking about and that you can already do with existing resources, is there anything that's within this bill that you can't already actually undertake in the task force, except for, adding some bodies?
Senator Winters, I'm not sure I understand your question. You're asking if there's anything we cannot
currently, I'm looking at the request, mm-hmm. and I heard you say that the structure or the work for the task mm-hmm. force can be done within existing structure.
Mm-hmm. So how?
Which means that you don't need any additional dollars
correct.
To do this. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So then my question is, why do we need the legislation?
Yeah.
The original principle that's embodied, and I may be mistaken, if I go back in time to all the legislation that's been passed, was the total integration of this population within the communities, including services.
Mm-hmm. Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, the reason for the bill, we believe, is because of that very reason, that when Fairview was closing in before, the idea of total community integration was central to it. And the legislature has said time and time again here in Oregon that the legislature agrees with that. And we believe that because this task force would create a report that would come back to you in 2016, it's critical to have this task force so you can continue to be involved in these discussions around community integration. And we think that the conversation is always ongoing. We're never going to be completely finished with community integration.
Any other questions? Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
We have at least one other person signed up to testify. Is Lynn here?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Lynn Boos, President and CEO of a nonprofit called Community Services Incorporated. I'm also here to talk on behalf of Oregon Rehab Association, which represents most of the programs that provide services to people who are intellectually and developmentally disabled. And perhaps, Senator Winters, I can add some to the comments that you are raising, the questions you're raising. And it's in the history here of the, and the purpose for this bill is to address the 1987-88 legislative decision to help settle a lawsuit between the state of Oregon and the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice, over failure to integrate its development of disabled people into the community, and receive federal money but not comply with the law upon receipt of it. So the legislature created a bill that allowed the mortgages, and these mortgages were converted into approximately 200 group homes between the period 1990 to 2000. I've been around for a long time since that period, helped take many clients out of Fairview. Currently today, we operate 25 group homes, of which 17 are called Community Integrated Program, or KIPP homes. Those programs are at risk, that program is at risk of ceasing to exist because the mortgage period will end in 2017. And that places at risk two things. Number one, a significant public investment by the state of Oregon in this housing, which effective in that time, at that time, 2017, becomes owned by the brokerages to which they were contracted. So the state loses control of the contracts at that time, and therefore the brokerages can choose to place replace the individuals now living in those with other higher paid renters. Currently, the Social Security Administration restricts the amount of money that a renter of these houses, in effect, can pay, which is $220. Non-Medicaid individuals would be able to pay higher, and so that's the issue. So what we're trying to do here is preserve this investment, this public investment, as well as address the current and immediate problem of loss of housing and the future of the policies for this particular special needs population.
Madam Chair,
did you have a follow-up?
I did, because we've been actually, he talked about 87, but the discussion has been going on since, and I was here in the 70s, since about 72 under Dr. Gene Black at Portland State, right, where we actually talked about normalization. So, in looking at that, I want to thank you for your clarification of the need for this, because I think it really is very important.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. Is there anyone here, anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 617? I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 617. We're moving now to a public hearing on House Bill 2522. Ms. Tope.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2522 comes to you from the House Committee on Health Care. It creates an Islander Health Coverage Gap Assessment Office in the Oregon Health Authority to promote access to health care for island citizens residing in the U.S. under the COFA agreement.
Thank you. There are three people signed up to testify. Please come on up. Mr. Mullen, did you want to testify also? You can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here this morning. First of all, I want to start by recognizing a couple of our representatives that are in this committee that are signed on to this bill, and our appreciation for their support in carrying this bill, Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Olson. Also to mention Senator Bates, co-chair, also with his help in this regard. We do in this House have a few folks also that I want to mention and acknowledge just their presence here, especially the COFA communities, folks from the Marshall Islands, Republic of Palau, and the Federated State of Micronesia, as you can see back behind me. And also have lots of supporters from the agencies, including the OCOPIA, Oregon Commission of Asian and Pacific Islander Agency, and the HOA, Oregon Health Equity Alliance, and APANO, Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Here with me is the Minister from Public Work of the Marshall Islands, and I will go ahead and have him go ahead and present whatever he's prepared for us this morning, and then I'll continue and we'll answer any questions you have. And just for the record, my name is David Anatok. I'm the president for the Oregon Marshallese community, and CAN board member as well for COFA Alliance National Network. Minister Hiroshi Yamamura.
Thank you, David. Honorable Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the Ways and Means, it is my great honor and pleasure to express my warmest greetings and heartfelt thanks to the honorable members of your committee, Madam Co-Chair, for allowing us such a rare opportunity to allow HB 2522 to be assigned to your committee. I know that this is not an easy task, and if House Bill 2522 ever reach the Senate floor, many questions will be addressed to you, Madam Co-Chair, and your members of the committee. And we're here to at least enlighten your committee on every angle on the merits of this bill as much as we can. The Compact of Free Association Agreement signed between the Republic of the Marshall Islands, the Republic of Palau, and Federated States of Micronesia, and the government of the United States is a unique diplomatic relationship. We are freely associated states of the United States, and at the same time, we are sovereign nation. In the international arena, COFA members voted in most of the United Nations General Assembly meetings the same way as the U.S. more often than all other nations apart from Israel. Under the COFA agreement signed in 2003, the United States provided guaranteed financial assistance over 20 years period that will be expired in 2023, and in return, the freely associated states give the U.S. the right to deny potential adversary access to the territory, airspace, territorial waters of the FSM Aramai and Palau. While the financial assistance to COFA states would be expiring in 2023, the Republic of the Marshall Islands and the United States signed the U.S. Military Use Operation Rights Agreement, which is called MURA, which allows the U.S. to use Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands for 83 years as a missile testing and space operation site. Kwajalein Atoll also played an important role during the Cold War, where the U.S. invented the concept of the Star War. We, the FAS, or COFA citizens, have played important roles to maintain security, prosperity, and peace to all the citizens of the United States by enlisting in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other parts of the world where U.S. is involved in keeping peace for the betterment of all human beings. Although the total population of FAS and COFA citizens is less than about 300,000, in comparison to U.S. citizens enlisted in the armed forces, our enrollment is extremely high. In accordance with the statistic provided the U.S. by the U.S. commentator on military enlistment, the federal state of Micronesia in 2008 had a higher per capita enlistment rate than any U.S. states, and had more than five times national per capita average of casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nine soldiers out of a population of 107. I'm proud to say that one of my sons is an active marine intelligent currently based in Japan. During the early years of the Cold War, from 1946 to 1958, the United States tested 67 nuclear weapons at its Pacific Proving Grounds, Bikini and Aniwata Atolls in the Marshall Islands, including the largest nuclear test ever conducted by the U.S. codename Castle Bravo. The bombs had a total yield of 108,496 kiloton, over 7,200 times more powerful than the atomic weapons used during the World War II, and by far 1,000 greater than the bomb dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. Nuclear claims between the U.S. and the Marshall Islands are ongoing, and health effects from these nuclear tests still linger. Project Point 41 was a medical study conducted by the U.S. of those residents of Rongrap and Utrecht atolls exposed to the radiation fallout. Most of the relatives who were residing on Utrecht at the time of the Bravo fallout died at young age, including my mother. I represent Utrecht atolls to one of the 33 seats in the Marshall Islands Parliament, and Utrecht atoll is one of the four atolls that was acutely affected by the radioactive fallout caused by Castle Bravo. Honorable co-chair and members of your committee, I humbly stand firm behind the good cause, which is reflected in the House Bill 2522. Thank you very much.
Mr. Yamamura, would you be willing to share your prepared remarks with us so that we may keep them in writing?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And now, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, I prepared a few pages up here in front of me, but I think I'm just going to speak from the heart after hearing again the statement remark from our Minister Yamamura from the Marshall Islands, which, by the way, came on a personal visit to his family's member. Three of his grandchildren were graduated from high school and middle school, so he was here on a trip, and then he's going on a business trip to Washington, D.C. He was supposed to leave yesterday, but he decided to stay with us today for this hearing. So I'm very humbled and honored. We thank you, Minister, for your time. As you've probably seen on the bill and some of the fact sheets that have been passed around. If not, we'll definitely visit those that we haven't seen yet and talk to you personally. But we do have, with the testing of the nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands and in the Pacific Islands, we have the highest rates in the chronic diseases. A lot of the folks today, especially the adults, those ones that we're targeting on this bill, under 133% of the FPL, either go to free clinics or wait till they go to the emergency room, which is their only access to healthcare at this point. They're only eligible for CALM program. A lot of the folks think that, well, even myself, I thought CALM was part of the Medicaid. I was misunderstood. When we sign up for the ACA program, the exchange, we're eligible. We get assistance there, but it's still part of the co-pays or out-of-pocket expenses that folks are still struggling with and still end up dropping out of their plans to wait until they go to the emergency rooms and be seen by a doctor. So this bill is very dear and near to our heart, as some of the words from the minister's mission, personal experiences, and stories that we live and people that are dying every day that we see go to their funerals. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, we had a friend of ours that was very close to us, went to his funeral services. He was from Ponape and had three daughters and two grandchildren, and he left them at a very young age. But yeah, this would be just part of what Oregon can do to make us feel more free, as it says on the Freely Associated States or Combat a Free Association. That being said, I Now remember, of course, the first bill Oregon State carried was the driver license bill, helped restore it to the 8 years, which was the first step towards making us more free, and especially being an Oregon resident. So I'll go ahead and stop there. There's a lot more to share, of course, and a lot that, as I said, I prepared. One big supporter that we do have, and they've wrote a statement to us, and I'll just share part of their paragraph. This is the National Atomic Association Veterans, or National Association Veterans, Atomic Veterans, excuse me. And this comes from their national commander, Fred Shaver. He wasn't able to be with us this morning, but he sent his letter, and we'll also share it with the committee if needed. The atomic testing which occurred on their islands has left their homeland uninhabited for thousands of years to come. Those who lived for countless generations on the islands used as nuclear test areas have died there or emigrated legally to Oregon and other states where many live and work for marginal wages. Many cannot afford health insurance, even though many of their health issues can be traced to the radiation exposure suffered upon them and their recent ancestors. We, the National Atomic Association Veterans, asking for your strong support for House Bill 2522 and request that your efforts continue on behalf of COFA. The time is now for funding health care access for these deserving people. Sincerely, Frederick Shaver, National Commander, National Association of Atomic Veterans. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you.
And members of the committee.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center has worked on House Bill 2934, which is the basic health plan, continuing that discussion. The reason that I bring that up is that the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, allows states to have a basic health plan. The bill has been signed into law by the governor, so we'll have discussion during the interim. And basically, it's because of affordability issues and inclusion issues. The legally present residents that are here in the United States are barred from Medicaid for 5 years. However, the COFA population are barred for a lifetime. They cannot receive Medicaid under normal circumstances. We have a hodgepodge of issues relating to people who are here legally, the legally present residents, asylees, refugees, and the COFA population and others. Sometimes it's hard to wrap your head around why these things happen, because you heard about the injustice that the COFA population suffers, the nuclear testing. Many people are also climate refugees, the changes that are happening in that area of the world. Moreover, we understand that Oregon has the fifth largest COFA population, not per capita, but the fifth largest population because of access to the West Coast and because there's a population already here. So all things considered, with the justice issues that are engaged here and envisioned here, the idea of having a COFA presence in the Oregon Health Authority certainly makes some sense to me. We look forward to having the discussion that we'll have on basic health during the interim, but I think this particular population deserves special recognition and support, and this is what the bill does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
Yeah, I have a question to John. Given the historic and the nature of this particular issue, will there be or has there been an elevated talk at the national level? Because it's probably just not unique to Oregon. It's probably some other states where this actually has a problem. So, John, do you know whether or not there is the effort to begin to elevate this discussion?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Winters, thank you for that excellent question. Congress has had a discussion, and I believe there's even a bill about the COFA population becoming eligible for Medicaid. However, as we all know, there are challenges in Congress with getting legislation passed. And so I think that while a national solution would certainly be preferable, because we don't have a national solution, I think we have to do the best we can in the state of Oregon to be inclusive of this population.
Thank you. That concludes our testimony. I don't have anyone else signed up to speak on this bill. Is that correct? Thank you for being with us this morning. I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2522. Ms. Toa, is there any other business before us this morning? That concludes our work this morning. This meeting is adjourned.